Okay, first I would like to thank the organizers for putting up such a nice meeting where the real diversity of new problems in X-ray science were discussed so far. I really enjoyed that. And then I want to thank you for staying until Friday for so that I have a chance to maybe attract you to some of the ideas and problems we are facing. So to please Robin, I mean, I will try to give you some sort of simple experimental challenges which we try to overcome to come up with some real hard challenges for theory at the very end. What I will try to show you is some applications of time-resolved spectroscopy, which we have been doing at FLASH in Hamburg at the free electron laser there, and which of course also carry over to new experiments we plan doing in Stanford in a short time. Now what we will be looking at is sort of a number of pump probe experiments, and what we want going to do is we will sort of play around with the order of some optical and XUV pulses. So we will start off with some optical excitations similar to the ones David discussed just in the previous talk, and then do some probing with XUV pulses. Then we will reverse the order to look into X-ray induced processes and do some very simple probing also by optical pulses. And at the very end, I will try to show you some results on XUV pump probe experiments, sort of single one color pump probe experiments. Just to mention, this is a large group effort, as all these FEL experiments actually are. We have to thank, of course, the FLASH team, who does a beautiful job in running this facility and giving us all the possibilities. I collaborate with my colleague Markus Drescher at the university, with Martin Wolf from the Fritz Haber Institute in Berlin, with Anders Nielsen in Stanford. And on the one particular example, which I will show, the tantalum disulfide, this was done in collaboration with Kai Rosnagel's group at the University of Kiel. Here are the members of my group involved in all these FEL activities. And the most important people are Martin Bayer, who did recently finished his PhD, Alexander Fölisch, who was running this program very successfully for a couple of years and now moved on to Helmholtz Center Berlin, formerly BESI, as to become a director of the instrumentation division there. Michael Martens, who built up the beamline actually and is running an ion spectroscopy program there. Bill Schlatter, who was a postdoc in our group and is now the instrument scientist at SXR, at LCLS. And Florian Sorgenfrei, who also is doing his PhD and is hopefully finishing at the end of this year. I should say that we have good support from our federal government in that they have set up a priority program on research and basically also give us funding to develop instrumentation for research with FELs. This is very nice. I'm happy to be the coordinator of this program, and there are a lot of universities involved, and this also enabled us to become partners in the SXR consortium and build the beamline in Stanford, actually. So what are we after? I mean, me and my other colleagues in the SXR consortium have some ideas about questions in soft X-ray material science, which could probably potentially be interesting to be solved with FEL radiation. And there are some questions here. You have seen in Bob's talk, Bob Schönlein's talk, that of course correlated materials is something which is very interesting in solid state physics. These materials have many, many different phases, and depending on very subtle changes in either electron density, spin, whatever, you will move through this phase diagram, and it would be nice to really understand and potentially also in the future being able to control these strongly correlated electron systems. And one hope is doing time-resolved spectroscopy to understand what the excitations do to your system, how the excitations drive the system from one state to another. Then there has been, Henry, I guess, has addressed already this question, how fast can we switch magnetization, which is a very interesting one, and is tackled by many in the solid-state physics community. And then, of course, there is also an interest in whether we can follow complex reactions in real time. There's been beautiful work on femtochemistry in sort of gas phase isolated systems, but I mean the question is, can we tackle this in more complex systems, like in surface catalytic reactions or in the liquid phase? Now, ideally, to understand these things and eventually maybe even control those, we would like to follow the position of the atoms, and that's what all your scattering efforts are about. But we would also like to see how the electronic states evolve. And if we know that at any given point in time, we could potentially map out all these multidimensional energy surfaces and see how complex systems find their way on these surfaces and evolve on these surfaces. Well, this may be far, but there are some challenges, especially if you're interested in the electrons. Electron spin and nuclear dynamics is the game here, and it's sort of the Bermuda Triangle of our solid-state physics samples. Electrons, phonons, spin, and the question how they dynamically interact and what their interplay is. If you think about the electrons, there are things like collective excitations, plasmon excitations, also screening, resonant electron transfer in these systems, electron hole pair excitations, multi-electron excitations, and what's on. On the phonon side, we deal with either molecular vibrations or phonons, which we heard in the previous talk. On the spin side, we can either have flips like stoner excitations, we can have precessional motion, spin waves, magnons going on, and all this is sort of coupled, and the question is, how can we understand what is going on in each particular system? And I guess time-resolved spectroscopy is a good handle to get a handle on these questions. Now we will ignore spin in the following. We will just look at electronic processes and coupling to lattice in some sense. And I've put up some sort of relevant timescales for electronic relaxation, where you see there's electronic dynamics, of course, in all these solid systems on the timescale of a couple of femtoseconds and then down to the attosecond regime, especially if you think about collective response, also about the dephasing of coherent excitations. And electron correlation effects also are in the attosecond to few femtosecond regime. Then there's electron-electron scattering, which is very important in these complex materials and solids. And then we have electron phonon scattering, which is more on the timescale of a couple of hundred femtoseconds up to picoseconds. Now, what can soft X-rays do for you? Now, you all know that. They can probe electronic structure. So they can give you a handle on the electronic structure, the energy density of states as a function of momentum, as a function of the atomic position, as a function of spin. And there are a multitude of beautiful techniques which have been developed, which go all with some acronyms. You always have to develop first the acronym, then the technique. You all know the angle-resolved photoemission, sort of the textbook examples nowadays for band structures in solids. Electron spectroscopy for chemical analysis, sort of the XPS version of photoemission. Then X-ray absorption, which gives you a handle on the unoccupied density of states, as was already shown by Bob in his talk, which is very sensitive to some of these effects. If you do this with some dichroism involved, you are sensitive to magnetic properties. And then there are X-ray emission spectroscopy, and I will talk about X-ray emission spectroscopy a little later. Now, what we're going to try is to go to pump probe versions of these static techniques. So from static to dynamic, just add another variable and put time here into this ballgame. Now, the opportunities at these free electron lasers in this regime are in the moment sort of threefold. I have left out the Japanese efforts here out of the picture. I'm sorry for that, Kiyoshi. But we didn't do so far experiments there, so I had to skip that. FLASH has been a user facility since 2005, running a very successful program. Sort of wavelength regime at the lower end, about 60 nanometers, and then recently not yet been in user operation, but demonstrated in machine operation after the shutdown is 4.45 nanometers. The soft X-ray material science station at LCLS has become operational in May 2010, which was quite a record. We had like 2 years to set this up, which this was really fast. And they did a marvelous job. And this will eventually allow us to go from 0.6 nanometers, which is sort of the limit of our optical elements, so 2 kV, up to, in the moment, approved, I heard, 540 eV at LCLS, and we are constantly pushing them to go to lower photon energies at that point. So we have been doing our experiment at this kind of beamlines at flash. So this is a end of the FEL. There's a gas absorber which helps us to attenuate the beam if we need to. There's a monochromator in between. There's a beam splitter. I will come back to that later. And then we can put some end stations over here. Now, we start with some optical pump XUV probe spectroscopy. And I will give you two examples, sort of an atomic view on the dynamics of charge order in tantalum disulfide from time-resolved core-level photo emission, and then snapshots of the electronic structure relaxation in highly photo-excited silicon taken with time-resolved X-ray emission spectroscopy. Now, one important question, and I guess this was also actually addressed many times in this meeting, is, of course, does optical heating or optical pumping sort of heat your electronic system? Is this what it really does? I mean, there are lots of two-photon photo emission experiments in the optical, and the basic result is if you, for example, look at metallic or semiconductor systems, you sort of depopulate the occupied states with your laser pulse, you excite those electrons into the unoccupied state, then they start to thermalize, and at some later time, you will have sort of the thermal Fermi Dirac distribution, which has a higher electron temperature. And you can see this in this experiment, for example, nicely. There's a logarithmic scale here. And you see at some point in time, this occupation above the Fermi edge, which is here, becomes sort of a straight line, which means that you have a Fermi Dirac distribution here for your electrons. Now, in, I guess, Jim Frerichs' talk, he already hinted at that this in correlated materials, it might be a little different. You don't really have a thermal distribution after the excitation. But this is a very interesting question which has to be solved at some point. Now, we looked at a system which we photo-excited, which is a very simple system, very well known, long studied. It's a layered system, so it's almost 2D, it's tantalum disulfide. And it's a layered charge density wave mod insulator system. So what does that mean? Well, this is sort of a structure, and what you see here is the charge ordered state, which is the so-called Star of David state, which has a 13-atom cluster state, where you see the blue atoms sort of move in a little bit from their positions in the metallic state. They are negatively charged. The red atoms are outside. And they are a little positively charged. You can see this sort of arrangement nicely in STM pictures. It gives rise to this kind of phase diagram. So you have a commensurate charge density wave state, then you have a transition into a non-commensurate, a nearly commensurate charge density wave, and then an incommensurate charge density wave until you reach the normal state. And this is accompanied by a large change in resistivity here. And this is actually a mod insulator transition. So here the resistivity drops. The idea about this mod insulator transition is that at high temperatures, you have sort of a metallic system, which is has a half filled band at the Fermi level, just qualitatively. And this is, of course, half filled band gives you a metal. But if correlations are important and correlation energies are comparable to the bandwidths here and the hopping, then this changes into, at some temperature, into a mod insulator where you have this lower Hubbert band and the upper Hubbert band here. Now, tantalum 4F photo emission, which is a core level in this system, also a low-lying core level, roughly 25 eV binding energy, is a very nice probe for this charge order because, as you can see here, at 10K in this charge ordered state, you get a nice, this is a spin orbit split to 4F levels, and you get a very nice splitting of these 4F levels, which actually monitor the charge state of the atoms. I mean, core level spectroscopy is sensitive to the charge surrounding the core level, and therefore you see directly here sort of this difference in charge state. If you look at the equilibrium dynamics of this system, you see when you heat the system thermally, this splitting goes away. I mean, it stays here in this nearly commensurate phase, and then it finally goes away if you go into the across the transitions. Now, what we did is we looked at this after photo excitation. So we hit this sample with an optical pump pulse, 800 nanometers, 120 femtoseconds. We probed it with the XLV pulse from flash, 156 CV, 160 femtoseconds, third harmonic. We use the third harmonic because it still gives us enough photons per pulse to really do a photo emission experiment, and it helps us, of course, to avoid any space charge problems in photo emission, in which we would have with a very high photon flux in the first harmonic. You see nicely without the laser, we have the split 4F signal. Now, minus 1.5 picoseconds, the laser is still not there. 0.3 picoseconds after the laser fired, we have a complete change in the splitting. So you see some remnants here, but this picture has completely changed. So after 300 femtosecond, your charge ordered state has sort of gone away. After 11 picoseconds, it still has not completely recovered. It takes about nanoseconds to really completely recover the system. But you see that after a picosecond, again, the second peak here sort of shows up. And if you compare this with the equilibrium data, this is very similar to this sort of nearly commensurate charge density wave phase, where you have actually domains of charge ordered phase and metallic phase. Now, conclusions from this electroinkly, yes?
I don't know if it's significant, but there is a difference between the minus 1.5 picosecond and
absolutely.
The laser. Absolutely.
Understood? This is space charge shift induced by the optical laser.
Okay.
Not by flash, but by the optical laser.
Okay.
You can show that there is a small shift in energy of the peaks induced by the electrons you generate with the optical laser. Because it takes longer for the space charge to recover. It's always there if you sort of have a sequence of pulses. So if you shut off the pulses and then wait for microseconds, then it's gone at some point. Yes, Penny. That's what I would consider. That's what I sort of subsumize under space charge in a sense. So it's sort of influence of electrons, other electrons on the photo ejected photoelectrons. Okay, so we're looking at an electronically driven transition here. Where we have to say we sort of from the timescales we can say that there's obviously transient decoupling of this charge density wave and the lattice distortion. So it's not really driven by the charge density wave. Is not really driven by the lattice distortion, by this Peierls transition. It has the same timescale as the Mott gap recovery, and we see a fast formation of this domain worlds, which is not expected if you really look at nucleation, theory. Now let me come to the second example, which is X-ray emission spectroscopy. Now we are going to look at electronic structure in a little bit more detail. So this is the electronic structure of silicon. Of course, I know that this is not a highly correlated material, but we did our first experiments also on simple systems, which also show interesting results. There's the silicon 2P core level. Here we have the valence band, some density of states features, peaks here, unoccupied conduction band. Now what we do is we photoionize actually the silicon 2P. Subsequently, we will have a lot of Auger decay, but also X-ray emission. And this X-ray emission, if analyzed energy resolved by a grating spectrometer, which is sort of a Rowland circle spectrometer, gives you a map of these occupied states. And actually what you get is a sort of a site and element specific map of the partial density of states, because you also, there's some symmetry rules involved, of course, in this dipole transition here. Now we want to go time resolved with this. So basically, model-wise, that means if we have a couple of electronic states, we pump the system, it evolves, we go through these electronic states, and for all time steps, we sort of probe the system with this X-ray V pulse, creating an X-ray emission spectrum. So here we have one, here we have another one, here we have the third one, and sort of what we get is an evolution of the electronic state. Now this is a perfectly nice model here for some three-state system. What is reality? Reality, we look at highly photo-excited silicon. So we take a Thai sapphire laser, 400 nanometer, use the same time structure as flash, put on 260 millijoule per square centimeter on the sample, which is quite a lot, gives rise to excitation densities of 10 to the 22 per cubic centimeter. And what we observe is this X-ray emission spectra, which sort of map the density of states here. Here you see the valence band edge. Here you see these density of states peaks, these L1 and L2 peaks. And we observe how they evolve in time. And this is now shown in this 2D plot here, actually. So what you see is the emission intensity in the X-ray emission spectra as a function of emission energy and pump probe delay. Now the emission energy, the photon emission energy, can be converted into a binding energy scale by simply taking into account the binding energy of the core level. And what we have here is sort of the valence band edge. Here are these density of states features in our band structure. Here's less intensity and so on. Now at time t equals zero, our optical laser sets in and we get a population of electrons in the conduction band. This sort of decays, as you can see, and as a sort of accompanying this decay of the hot electrons in the conduction band, you see a shift of the valence band edge. It actually sort of temporarily, the band gap completely vanishes, and you see very strong changes down here in these band structure features. So this peak completely goes away. This one gets smaller and smaller. So complete sort of picture of the electronic structure after this strong evolution, after this strong photo-excitation pulse. Now what is behind that? We think what we see, and somehow the referees believed us, is a liquid-liquid transition in silicon, actually, which is going on here. So these are calculated densities of states for different phases of silicon. This is a crystalline phase, as we have seen before. This is what people call a low-density liquid, and this is sort of the equilibrium phase, which is a high-density liquid. Silicon is one of these nice systems where your liquid phase is denser than the solid phase. So you get, it's like water, in a sense. This is a characteristic of one of these tetrahedrally bond systems, where sort of the you can increase the coordination in the liquid and have a denser state there. Now, these are calculated densities of states for the different phases. If you look close to the Fermi level, take those into account, sort of, and look at the occupation, what we get, if this is for the crystalline phase, this would be for the low-density liquid, which has a sort of so-called pseudo-gap state here, and this is the metallic high-density liquid. And what you see here is sort of a shift of the valence band edge, which you would see in your spectroscopy, and this is what we observe here on the time scale. After the excitation, we see a gradual shift of the valence band edge. It stays constant for some time, and around 4 to 5 picosecond, there's another jump, and it sort of moves over here. So what we think is we observe sort of the crystalline phase, then the low density liquid, and then over here, the change into the high density liquid phase. Okay, now we change order of pulses. So we take the optical pulse after the X-ray V pulse. This was actually an experiment which we did first. And what it does is it looks at XUV-induced reflectivity changes in this case, also semiconductors, gallium arsenide. We use gallium arsenide because there's many, many data on optically excited gallium arsenide and relaxation. So our X-ray pulse or XUV pulse, it's actually not X-ray, it's XUV 40 UV, hits the gallium arsenide, optical laser probes the reflectivity. What you see is you get a very fast drop in optical reflectivity, then the system overshoots, you get an increase in the reflectivity, and then finally it goes back to the original value. Here you see enhanced part of this delay scan. You see that this initial drop is extremely fast. It's actually all, the scale here is limited by our pulses and by the experimental resolution. So this initial drop in reflectivity is quasi-instantaneous. This is kind of nice because this gives us experimental possibilities. We can use this as a cross-correlator to actually measure arrival times of optical pulse and XUV pulse. But the question is, what is going on? And we think what is going on is ultra-fast electron relaxation. So again, we create core states. Gallium 3D in this case is the highest cross-section for photoabsorption. Then we have fast OG decay and electron-electron scattering, which leads to possibly electron thermalization, and then would explain our change, instantaneous change in reflectivity, because these processes are extremely fast on sub 10 femtosecond timescales. That's at least what we expect. Okay, oops, too fast. Not extremely fast, but too fast. Now we come to XUV pump, XUV probe. How do we do that? We developed a split and delay unit where we can split the FEL pulse in two and delay them with respect to each other. This has a certain beauty to it because it gives you fully synchronized stable pulses. So actually it gives you a very high time resolution in your experiments. I will show two examples if time permits and chairman permits. This is the split and delay unit. Here you see how this is split. It's sort of a Mach-Zehnder type interferometer thing where you split the pulse by simply dividing the wavefront with a mirror. Then you go over an arrangement of additional four mirrors and recombine the pulse again. And what you can do is, this was also shown by Matthias Richter in one of his talks, you can measure pulse lengths of the flash pulses on the order of 35 femtoseconds by using intensity autocorrelation on a nonlinear process, in this case helium-2 ionization. But you can also look at sort of fringe visibility when you recombine the two pulses under a small angle, and what you see is sort of the temporal coherence. So if you look at the fringe visibility as a function of delay between the two pulses, you see that it vanishes, and it vanishes much on a much shorter time scale than actually the pulse widths. So the temporal coherence of the FEL pulse is on the order of 10 femtoseconds.
But with the way you've drawn it, there's no delay.
There's no delay? Here's no delay. Oh yes, there is delay if I move this in this direction. So I make these two paths different. And I move sort of the rays on these mirrors, on the surface of this mirror. And the only movement I have to do is I move this whole thing, which is about a meter, just parallel to the beam, perpendicular to the beam, sorry. Okay, what we tried to do is, we thought it's an easy experiment to do molecular excitation in a two-pulse experiment. So the first pulse, excite an N2. You have seen pictures like that from Joachim in the first talk of this meeting. Second pulse, go to a repulsive curve and look at the resulting ions. This turns out to be a very difficult experiment, and with very, on the other hand, I think very interesting results, not fully understood actually. What we see is if we plot the N2 plus ion yield, which is measured with a very simple time of flight spectrometer, we see sort of an oscillating signal. There is probably more than one oscillation period in this signal if you Fourier transform that. And the one strange thing is this peak, which also was discussed by Joachim, which actually coincides completely with the coherence peak we have with the temporal coherence peak of the N2. So the black curve is the coherence curve measured in the same experiment, and the red curve is the N2 plus ion signal. So we are not so sure what to make out of that. Maybe other people have some ideas. Joachim had some explanation with some very fast dynamics in the N2, which actually would coincide on this sort of on the same be on the same time scale as this coherence peak. Now, going back to silicon, we can do also XUV pump probe experiments now on silicon. Again, going back to the X-ray emission spectroscopy. First experiment, not a two-pulse experiment, but combining the two pulses at time t equals zero and looking at the fluence dependence. What you see is here is plotted the fluence dependence of the valence band, and this is goes of sort of linear with the fluence of your X-ray XUV pulse, which is sort of simply more photons, more signal. In the X-ray emission spectroscopy, if you look at the conduction band occupation and you integrate over the conduction band occupation, you see that this goes with the intensity like 1.2 to the power of 1.7. So that means sort of with the front of the pulse, you create your electrons through core excitation, Auger decay, electron thermalization, and with the back of the pulse, you probe it with a second photon, again doing a core excitation and an X-ray emission process. But now, of course, we wanted to have this delay unit to do some time-resolved experiments. And so what we did is we hit the silicon sample with two pulses and varied the delay between the two pulses. And what you see here is a spot of 40 times 85 microns. So you see, and now look at the conduction band electrons integrated. You see that this hot electron signal sort of drops on a 310 femtosecond time scale. If we increase the spot size, make the spot bigger, 50 times 150 microns, we get something like a 500 femtosecond decay time of our hot carrier population. And then we sort of shifted the two pulses with respect to each other by about 70 micron and looked again at what happens. Sort of at one pulse, you excite the system, and at the second pulse, you probe it at a different location. And what you see here, your hot electron distribution sort of goes up, and you have a peak at around 1.4 femtoseconds. Now, what is that all about? Well, it's sort of diffusion of carriers, which you see. That's what we think. But it's an interesting case, because if you really look, you have fast creation of the carriers through this Auger decay and inelastic electron scattering. Then you have a subsequent diffusion of your hot carriers out of the probing volume. And in fact, the probing volume is not very large. The probing depth is probably about 20 nanometers. So what you would expect is actually that you see almost nothing of your hot electron carriers after this short period of time. So what has to happen is somehow some of the carriers have to be sort of confined to the surface layer where you're very sensitive to. And this is sort of what we think is the reason for that might be the charge imbalance at the surface layer, because there you have electrons actually escaping and holes staying behind, which gives rise to a large field at the surface. And this would probably also explain why, if you go here 70 microns, this is quite a distance in 1.5 femtoseconds. This means that you have extremely fast motion of carriers, and therefore, you probably need those high fields which you create by this imbalance at the surface. So that's sort of speculation and a challenge for theory. Perspective, wow, you can all, as I've showed, you can do all kinds of pump probe experiments and exploit the possibilities doing these combinations of IR or optical, terahertz or optical, with XUV soft X-rays. Look at photo-induced changes in electronic structure, switching, magnetization dynamics, photoelectrochemistry. You can, if you turn it around, come with the XUV soft X-rays first and then probe with the optical. You can create well-defined, localized excited states in complex systems. Your soft X-rays will do the excitation at a specific location in a complex molecule, for example, because you are sort of energy selective for specific core level excitations, which would probably also help in these complex solid-state materials where you can sort of look at different edges, manganese, oxygen, whatever. And then, of course, our dream would also be then the XUV pump probe to really go into nonlinear processes like the ones Shaul has described. But that's probably a long way to go because we really have to see how we're doing there in terms also of timing and coherence in a sense. So shorter timescales are of course possible. People talk about sub-femtosecond already at LCLS, sub-femtosecond. There are plans how to do that, and I guess this opens up a bright future for powerful short pulse soft X-ray sources. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for that stimulating talk. Questions?
Well, I wanted to know what the reasoning was. So back on tantalum disulfide, what was the reasoning for saying that the lattice was not participating in the transition? That it was a...
The reasoning was
that... there was a decoupling between the electronic and the lattice.
Yes. The reasoning was that we see already the complete vanishing of this charge, this difference signal in the core level spectroscopy on a time scale of less than 300 femtoseconds.
But isn't that signal to start with because there's a lower lattice symmetry in the CDW state than there is
in the
normal
state? No, the core levels are sensitive to the charge distribution.
Yeah,
what you
charge,
see is
the charge modulation is a few hundredths of an electron.
No, the charge modulation is fairly large. If you actually look back here. Here we go. The scale here says red is about 0.5 electron plus, and blue is about minus 0.5 electron.
That gives rise to this large
splitting.
I mean, delta CDW in almost all the dichalcogenides is less than 50 milliEV. It's like a niobium diselenide, it's only 3 millivolts if you measure it with RPEG.
Delta CDW, when you talk about splitting of the energy levels at the Fermi level.
Yeah, that's what
I'm
talking
about. But what I'm talking about is the splitting of the core levels due to the difference in sort of valence charge around the core level.
But those two quantities are related.
That's my delta CDW, so it's sort of not the conventional delta CDW.
Okay, it's a longer conversation then. But those two numbers are the same number, right?
Hmm?
Those two numbers are the same number because
nope.
It's the modulation of the density of states that gives you the charge modulation in the CDW.
Then there's a lattice distortion,
which is a distinct thing.
Yes, that's true, but the sort of the energy modulation at the Fermi level is different from the energy splitting of the core levels.
That's clear. Well, all right.
That's all I'm saying.
I can comment on that a little more. A similar material, I think it's tantalum diselenide, was looked at with RPs with high harmonics, and there they see a collapse of the charge order even faster than 30 femtoseconds. Okay.
I don't think so. I mean, people have done this for quite some time in equilibrium, and they have calculated these numbers. I there is no question about it. I agree with you, but it's the difference to what you see in core level splitting. The amount is different. That's all I'm saying. We can discuss this in more detail.
So I found your last observation when you had the different probing and exciting spot very interesting. So is that similar to what we have found in clusters where you have what we call field ionization from the surface? That you create a positive charge.
Right.
There it's in the center, right? And you suck in the electrons, the bound electrons towards this positive charge. So you would think you create like a hotspot of positive charge
yes.
one place, and that sucks in the electrons from the other one where you probe later on.
Yes, that's sort of could be a possible explanation. We were inspired by some of your thoughts on clusters. But it's also there are some people also looking at silicon, highly excited silicon with other means, and there's some evidence that there are kind of high fields which are created in, close to the surface.
With this very nice split and delay instrument, when you measure the coherence length, temporal coherence length versus the pulse length, that was at the monochromator beam line.
Yes.
And if you estimate the numbers, can you understand why the temporal coherence is smaller than the pulse?
You can correlate the temporal coherence which you observe with the spectral distribution you measure. And you, in fact, in this paper which we published on this, you can show that sort of the spike structure which you have, which is less spiky at flash, of course, because you are at XUV energies and pulses, so you have on the order of two to three modes in your pulse. This actually nicely Fourier transforms into the temporal measured print visibility. Mm-hmm. So this connection via that's called Wiener-Kinchen theorem holds up, and you can demonstrate that this is really true.
But I would assume that would be without the monochromator. Now you put the grating monochromator in, and you should easily get to a fully coherent pulse.
I did the data I showed were taken in zero order, so that's without monochromatizing the beam. But of course, if you monochromatize your beam, you increase the temporal coherence. You can show that, and we have done experiments like that.
A second question was when you showed the melting transition in or the liquid-liquid phenomenon in the silicon, you said that the band structure would vanish at some point. I didn't see that in this 2D data. That looked very
Well, band structure vanishes probably a bit. So what you see here.
Yeah, but if you go to the
what you see here is that this, so these features go away, right? Now, if you go to this here, you see that this feature here goes away, which is actually the sum of these two with the experimental resolution you have. This feature stays. This is the other one, which we have up here. So it changes, but it stays. So the two very sharp density of states features, the L1 and L2 point features, really go away. And actually, if you plot the ratio of these two peaks, they show exactly the same time behavior as this valence band edge curve.
Ready for the call?